Is there a record of this?
Why would he file a police report?
When the gun goes off.
Failing to kill himself.
Well, your bullet goes through the wall. Where did it go? Did it hit somebody else?
It went into a tree, he said.
He went into a tree. Okay.
It went through the wall and through the front door.
Did the neighbors hear the gun go off and call the police?
I don't know. Dr. Drew didn't ask him all these questions.
I would.
Jeebus. He's a doctor. Not the detectives.
Not a cop.
Ruining it.
That's why there was a show called Dr. Cop. Are we done yet? Seems like we've done a full hour of this to me.
Whatever, I like it. It's like a nap.
Okay, good. Because you were kind of down on the topic.
I mean, it's boring as hell and it's an awful topic, but I like that it was kind of slow and sleepy.
It's kind of relaxing.
So call us at 201-209-9368. Since we haven't really had any good calls, you could technically win.
We've had a couple good calls.
Well, just one.
I would say we've not had any, like, great calls.
I liked the tail call.
The tail call.
But only when he said that it was going to wrap around.
I like Johnny Mueller's call. He thought through this topic. It would have been better if he had, like, you know, one clear vision, but he had four small clear visions. That's good. That's a good thing. You just yawned again.
I'm tired. I've had a rough week.
So have I.
FMU, you're on the radio.
Yeah, I already got a prize, so I'm out of the running. And I would like to have a nacho dispenser built bottomless, with choice of sides like guacamole or cheese. And on my right hip is a beer dispenser, and on my left hip is a scotch dispenser, top shelf, and
so,
they're all bottomless.
So the beer and the scotch and the nachos would come out of you, and then you'd imbibe them again.
Endlessly, and then I could be a big, fat mamma jamma. And all the chubby chasers can go even more wild.
Well, actually, you'd be a closed system, so you'd never change weight.
I wouldn't have to. And the thing is like, you wouldn't have to worry about, like, crumbling nachos on your chest because they go right back in the mix.
You'd absorb them through osmosis, and they'd come out again through the dispenser.
Can he win?
Sure,
no,
why not?
I already got a t-shirt. Thank you, dear.
Yeah, but I can send you something else.
He can be an honorable mention.
Send me your heart.
Okay, Chris from Brooklyn, Nacho Man.
He can win in special category.
Nacho Man.
Yeah, I like that.
Have a good holiday, sweeties.
You too, have a good one. That was good. Although that's not a body part.
Well, sure, why not?
It is once it's attached, right?
Well, aren't there other animals that give out food through their bodies?
Not nachos.
Like all females?
Ew. Or,
yeah.
Yuck.
Also, they give out other bodies to their bodies.
Okay, gross.
Some asexual organisms do that as well.
Tom Elise wants me to give a prize to the people in the comments board, which I would do if they had good comments and didn't spend the whole hour fighting with one another.
Yes, you comment people are theoretically eligible to win the prize. Oh, if we notice you.
Someone says that what Mr. Lohan said wouldn't happen with a 45. Why?
I don't know enough about guns to
rule
on that.
Would a fat Frangry be more jolly?
No. You'd just be just as bitter and acerbic as you are now.
I would just be fat Frangry.
Yeah.
Call us at 201-209-9368. What extra body part would you want?
We're waiting.
No.
Now what?
Now someone's requesting pictures of me Photoshopped to look fat. What is it with these freaks? They really... You know, I was thinking...
I heard
the
there's
name
an
of
iPhone
our show
app that makes you look fat.
Could not be more perfect. Right?
That's why we chose it.
I mean, but that was before we knew what freakazoids our callers would be.
Well, I think we knew with a call-in show, you'd get a certain amount of freakazoidness. Huh. And that certainly does pop up from time to time. Like you keep telling me, it's not Washington Week in Review, Andy. It's not Meet the Press.
It's not NPR.
It's not NPR. It's NPR from another dimension.
Call us at 201-209-9368. What extra body part would you want? Oh my God, it's almost over. What do we do for the next 4 minutes?
We have to
Should
wait
I go
for
through
the,
my list?
We have to wait for Amanda to show up to board up the next show.
Okay, we have Johnny
yes,
Mueller with the Brain Exchange. Listener Mike with the tail, which I loved because it was so cute and romantic. And Chris from Brooklyn with the nachos. Andy?
I'm listening.
But which one do you like?
Well, why not Brain Exchange? Or nachos? Or Brain Nachos?
What? You don't like the tail? I like the tail.
You get to be the final arbiter if you want to go with the tail.
Only because I want someone to wrap their tail around me. Well, I need that, love too, you know.
Is that enough of a reason?
Yes. It doesn't matter what my reason is. I can choose whoever I want.
Yes, you can choose whoever you want.
All right, listener Mike, email me your address at shutupweirdo@wfmu.org. Your address and t-shirt size. Andy and I will not be here next week. We will find a fill-in, so don't bother listening. And, but we'll be back the week after, Andy, right? Should we announce our topic so they have time to think about it?
No, we can do that like a week out. And everything will be fine.
But it's so good. Okay.
Do you want to give a hint?
It's good.
It's good. Yeah, that's your hint, yeah. That it's good. Okay, well, I guess we'll wrap up the show just a little bit early. You want to take one more call?
We don't have any.
So usually you want to take one more call, and I don't want you to do that.
That's because usually we have calls. Today we do not.
All right. Butt puss. Happy Canada Day. You have been listening to Shut Up Weirdo here on WFMU. You can comment during the show at WFMU.org. Please visit our website, shutupweirdo.com, where we have supplemental information regarding the topic, where we announce the topic in advance.
Oh, my God.
And we have time. And we have links to our pages on Facebook, Twitter, and iTunes. Plus our archives.
Do you want to give my social security number?
Why don't you give it to? Put your number out on there. You can write us at shutupweirdo@wfmu.org. I'm Andy.
Frangry.
She's Frangry. Up next is Stuff You Should Know. Then at 8 o'clock, pour yourself a glass of Mr. Fine Wine. You are listening to WFMU, the great one. WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, live and archived at wfmu.org. So let's
end it here.
Time for Josh and Chuck and Stuff You Should Know, the program that blows your mind on a weekly basis with astonishing facts from around the world. This is the radio version of the Stuff You Should Know podcast, which is available from HowStuffWorks.com. Tonight, Josh and Chuck explore how to start your own country, and then in part two, they look at Thomas Malthus and his predictions on the carrying capacity of planet Earth. Now here's Josh and Chuck.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I haven't said that in a long time, and I said it just like P.F. Tompkins for some reason.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, that's kind of how he would say it.
But you're not wearing a vest and bow tie.
No, and my mustache is non-existent, too.
Or a pork pie hat.
I've got nothing except for that one inflection.
Okay.
That's the only similarity.
So Josh is in a great mood because it's Friday.
Yeah.
And we're actually... not like we aren't usually pleased to be here, but we haven't done this in 2 weeks because we've been doing other stuff and we stacked up, you know, recordings. And it's like, it's a genuine pleasure to be back in here doing this.
It is.
Like, I feel like I could do this with my eyes closed.
Yeah. Try it. Start podcasting.
I can't see my notes.
Okay. Well, it's still pretty good, Chuck. You got a joke in there anyway.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here because I know I can do this.
Right.
You know?
There's not a camera in front of us.
Exactly.
Making us feel inferior.
Yeah. You feel good?
Mm-hmm.
I feel good too, Chuck. So I'm going to use that good feeling to give you an introduction, okay?
Let's hear it.
Let's say, Chuckers, that you did not have a very good time in high school.
But I did. But I'll imagine that I did not.
You're suspending disbelief here.
Okay.
You were one of the less popular kids. Perhaps because of that one time you wore that cape to school,
yeah.
It didn't go nearly as well as you had expected it would.
I thought I would be lauded as a superhero among my peers.
Right.
But they made fun of me.
Right.
Okay.
And that pretty much set the timber for the rest of your high school experience.
and life.
It really stuck with you, you know?
Uh-huh.
It really got in your craw that you were so mistreated in high school.
Right.
And you had a couple of friends, Kevin and Jim.
Mm-hmm.
And they had similar experiences, and you guys are now in your 30s or 40s. You've got a little money, and you still are driven by bitter anger.
Right.
You want vengeance, right?
Right.
So you're not exactly the type to kill somebody.
No.
And your idea of revenge is pretty grand. So what you decide to do is to start your own country.
Hey, that's a good way to get back at the jerks in high school.
Exactly. This is the legal way to do it, right?
Okay.
All you do, start your own country, and you invite these guys to come visit, and then throw them in prison the moment they get there.
Okay. Done.
Maybe even put them on a terrorist watch list before they get there.
Uh-huh.
And not alert your authorities of what's going on. And then just sit back and wait for the good times to roll.
Right.
Okay?
All right. Done.
There's a couple of problems here.
Okay.
One, you have no idea how to start your own country.
Well, I do in real life because I've read your article, but yeah.
Well, that's what I was going to say. We're here to tell you.
That's right.
So everyone who hears this podcast will know how to start their own country, pretty much. And it's easier than you'd think.
In theory, sure.
Well, let's talk about it, Chuck.
All right.
Okay.
Well, one way, Josh, that you can do so, and history has shown that it's works, is a larger nation, let's say Great Britain. They used to be into colonizing places all over the world.
Yeah, here or there.
Lovely places that they like to relax on the beach.
Mm-hmm.
And they did so, well, Rhodesia's not exactly on the beach, but I was speaking of like the Virgin Islands.
Sure.
But they did that. A larger nation colonized a smaller one and changed the name to Rhodesia and said, this is a new country.
Yes, you are now Rhodesians.
Yep.
And if you don't like it, we've got guns here.
And that is one way to do it.
And then there's the opposite way to do it.
Uh-huh.
You could be a Rhodesian and be like, you know what? We have guns now, too.
Right, or Zimbabwe.
And now this place is called Zimbabwe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Zulu, 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 Zulu.
Yeah. And then there's, let's see, the kind of secession that where you go buy an island.
Yeah.
And basically say, okay, this island is now its own thing.
Yeah. I think, didn't Marlon Brando own his own island?
Yeah.
I don't think he tried to make it his own country, although he may have.
There are a significant number of islands for sale in the world.
Really?
Yeah.
They're pretty small, though, huh? Or I guess they range.
I mean, they're small enough, or they're big enough.
Right.
The problem is the getting electricity. That's the big problem, I think.
Yeah. Although, if I was going to buy an island, I would try and keep it off-grid, you know? Or you know, do the solar thing or
would
something
like
that. Sure, yeah.
Heck yeah. Oh, man. I'd deck my island out.
Well, I'd want mine decked out, though, but you can still deck it out with solar panels. And
like the Swiss Family Robinson or something?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
That's just how I roll.
But the more customary way of starting your own country is, like we were saying, say Zimbabwe or something like that, is called a land-based secession.
Yeah, not as easy.
No, it really isn't, because whereas if you were to buy a deserted tropical island that a country technically owned but wasn't doing anything with, they probably wouldn't put up too much of a fight. If you own property in a country and say, this is no longer part of this country, you're going to get some sort of resistance.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right?
Like Russia. Soviet Union obviously dissolved, and they're still doing battle with Georgians, you know, today.
They
didn't just forget and say, yeah, it's no big deal.
Right, yeah. Relations among the former Soviet states with Russia are definitely strained.
Yeah, where else? Chechnya?
Yeah, Chechen rebels are not the most happy people around.
Right. Yeah.
And they will kill children, they've shown, to secede.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Secessions are bloody and horrible.
Oh, were they the school?
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
What was it? The SWAT podcast?
Yeah, I think so.
Let's see. What else? Oh, Yugoslavia.
Yeah.
That's another really good example, too. There's a guy named Joseph Tito, right?
Not Tito Jackson.
No. Okay. Or Tito's Handmade Vodka.
Okay.
Tito was this guy who was a brutal, iron-fisted dictator. But he had a reputation where people would say, Tito is a brutal, iron-fisted dictator. But you got to hand it to him. He's keeping Yugoslavia together, and this is amazing.
Right.
This Yugoslavia, before Tito and then after Tito, were a bunch of ethnic people, groups living together that had hated each other for 1,000 years.
Right.
like the, I think the problem between the Albanians and the Serbs went back to a massacre or the murder of a martyr in like 12 something,
really?
In the 13th century.
Wow.
So Tito comes along and is like, nope, you all live together in my country.
Uh-huh.
After Tito dies, Yugoslavia falls apart, and all of a sudden you have Albania, Serbia, all that stuff.
Right.
But these were huge, enormous problems for the world. The Balkans are a big match, or a big flashpoint, right?
Sure.
But ultimately what happened was a bunch of ethnic Albanians said, you know what? We're no longer part of Serbia. We have our own nations now.
Right.
That's one way to do it. That's land-based secession. And like we said, it's usually kind of bloody, right?
That's right.
But there are a few steps that Albanians took, that Serbs eventually took, and that other people have taken that are basically like a four-part means of becoming an independent nation.
Yeah.
So also I have to give a huge shout out to Joshua Keating, who wrote a really cool article on foreign policy at Foreign Policy Magazine about this. That formed the basis of this article. It's just way better.
His
is way better.
Oh, really?
No, mine is way better than the editor at Foreign Policy Magazine.
Exactly. So three things, Josh, and we're going to talk about the four steps, but three things that generally give you a leg up if you want to form a new country is a population of, I would guess, like-minded folks.
Not just a population, a permanent population. Like,
this is
these people's homeland, or this is where they live, this is where they farm.
Right.
Not they're on vacation here. Let's get a country going. Huh?
Yeah, exactly. Government and land. That'll really give you a leg up if you've got those three things. It's a good starter kit.
And there's a fourth one that's not necessarily. Those three are internationally recognized as yes. If you have those three things, then you're on your way to forming a country.
There's a fourth currency.
The fourth is that government has to be able to communicate with the outside world.
Oh.
That came out of a treaty in 1933 in Montevideo, where the U.S. said, okay, we'll leave Latin America alone. You guys are your own sovereign nations now.
Right.
We'll just undermine you covertly rather than overtly.
Right.
That's kind of disputed. I think the United States recognizes it still, but other countries don't necessarily see that as criteria for nationhood.
Well, it's tricky, and we'll see here in a minute when we start talking about the awesomely funny and wacky Sealand.
I can't wait.
Being recognized, it's some people recognize certain things, and some people say you're a sovereign nation, and then or an independent. It's very formal and informal whether or not you're recognized or not, and I can't really tell when you're a legitimate country anymore.
No, really, the only way there isn't.
There's another recognized country recognizes you as
even,
a country.
Even that doesn't necessarily mean anything because take Taiwan.
Mm-hmm.
Taiwan used to be a recognized country, part of the UN, and then in 1971, Nixon threw it to the dogs as an olive branch to China, and Taiwan hasn't been part of the UN since then.
Are they trying to be?
Yes.
Really?
Every
and
couple of years,
vetoed?
They petitioned to come back into
right.
the UN, not even come in the first time, to come back.
Right.
They got booted out because Nixon was like, yeah, the U.S. isn't backing you any longer.
We got our little empty chair there with our little placard. I see it right there with the microphone.
Exactly.
There's a little earpiece interpreter.
It has like a cobweb
dust
on it.
Please.
But yeah, so Taiwan is a sovereign nation as far as it's concerned, as far as many other nations are concerned, but it's not officially recognized by other countries.
Right.
It's,
well,
you know, very big, important one.
Yeah, and UN protection, that's big because that means that your former country, if you're all of a sudden recognized by the UN, can't roll in there and take you back by force, at least per the UN's rules, they can't.
They're not supposed to,
yeah.
No. Because once you do that, that's war. And once you've completed step two, which is declare independence.
Right. You got to write your own Declaration of Independence.
Right. And then once you write your own Declaration of Independence,
send it to the important people that need to see that, I guess.
Right. Well, the country that you're seceding from.
Well, sure. They'd be first on the list.
Sure. And then if you can get recognized, then you're a sovereign nation, basically, on the international stage. And that's an act of war, an unprovoked act of aggression on par with Pearl Harbor or 9/11 or
right.
whatever.
Sure. And I think that what you mentioned, Kosovo and Montenegro, is being on the winning side of those laws that kept them protected from Serbia.
Yeah. So that's because the U.S. recognized Kosovo
as a,
on the day it declared independence. George Bush was like, "Hey, we're going to recognize you as a sovereign nation," and they were like, "What?" And
he said,
like,
"Kosovo, yeah. We recognize you."
Yeah, right. And the reason why Keating points out that back in the day during the Cold War, it used to be that all you had to do was say, "I'm anti-Soviet," and the U.S. would recognize you immediately.
Right.
Or you could be like, you know, American capitalist pig dogs, and the USSR would be like, "Hey, you're on our team. You're a country."
Right.
But
and they both start printing stamps.
Right. But with Kosovo in particular, declaring independence, it was kind of like a thumb in the eye to Russia.
Right.
Because, you know, former Soviet state satellite.
Sure.
And so Bush recognizing it was kind of like a to the Russians.
A what, Josh? What was that?
You know what it was.
Yes, Josh, and those rules that we're talking about, the UN rules, are a remnant of the Cold War to protect new states that were not yet recognized by one side of the bloc or the other.
Right. They hadn't unilaterally declared their
allegiance. And that's BLOC, not New Kids on the Block with a K.
Did they spell theirs with a K?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That wouldn't be New Kids on the Block. That would have been a different band.
So that was the first three steps, I believe, right? You have criteria, declare independence, you petition for UN recognition, and I should also say it's incredibly easy to petition for UN recognition.
It's almost cute how easy it is. It's almost adorable that you can just write a letter.
Tell them, Chuck.
Well, you just write a letter to the Secretary General and say, "I would like to be a country." I don't even, that was a mix of like eight accents, so
right.
Don't call me
it
out on
sounded
that one.
A lot like
vodka.
Oh, yes, that's exactly who it sounded like.
Thank you very much. So, you just write a letter, and getting in, I mean, the letter writing part is easy.
That's the big part. And, as a matter of fact, as a PSA, we're going to give you the address to send your letter to if you are going to declare your independence. You want to address your letter to Ban Ki-moon, Secretary General, the United Nations, First Avenue at 46th Street, New York, New York, 10017. And all you have to do is say, "Mr. Bon, we would like to be a nation. We have a sedentary population.
Mm-hmm.
We have a government. Our government can even talk to people if you're into that kind of thing."
Yeah, we've got phones.
And we have a geography. So let us in, huh? Chuck, also, to be accepted into the UN, you need recognition by a two-thirds vote.
Okay.
And a two-thirds majority says that you're a, quote, peace-loving state that can carry out the duties of the UN Charter. That means you are in.
Yes, but that can be easily vetoed by member nations. And like you pointed out in the article, I guess it's you want to make friends with the big players in the UN and get them on your side. That would definitely help.
Yeah. There's a, you know, neutral countries are always like, "Sure, well, we're neutral, whatever you want to do, pal."
Right, right. They don't carry much weight, though.
No, not nearly as much as, you know, the you could basically call them bully countries.
Yeah.
Countries that have the economic and military might to push everybody else around.
Right.
Make decisions for the rest of the world. So if you can get recognized and get in bed with one of those guys,
mm-hmm.
Your nation's going to start to thrive. Another way to get your nation to thrive is to attract foreign investors.
Yeah. You pointed out natural resources. If you happen to have an island, like,
it's a big one.
Let's say the Waponi Woos had Boobaroo, you remember.
I don't remember that.
Boobaroo was this mineral, I believe, that the Waponis had.
Mm-hmm. I remember he wanted their island. That was the whole point.
He wanted it for Boobaroo because it helped out with whatever his business was. Lloyd Bridges, of course, we're talking about.
He was so great.
The late, great Lloyd Bridges.
I liked his little stint on Seinfeld toward the end of his life.
Man, that was so good.
He just came out of nowhere.
Because he was the father of the old trainer, right?
He was the trainer, and then his son would like drive the car,
right,
while he was turned around like shouting out of a bullhorn at Jerry.
But wasn't there even an older, like, wasn't his father also?
No, his son was an old man.
Okay, that's what
it was. And he was like
the older man.
Yeah.
Anyway, we were talking about Joe versus the Volcano, obviously, which we've mentioned before, and in that movie, he wanted the mineral rights to this imaginary element or mineral, and that's a good way to get sovereignty, is to attract, I guess, a wealthy entrepreneur and say, hey, I've got some awesome sand on this island.
Right. You've got that. You can also create currency and back it with said mineral or natural resource.
Yeah.
Like this is $8 gas bucks.
Yeah, yeah.
If you have natural gas.
What's this Nevada thing?
There's a guy who, what's the name of the place?
The Republic of Molassia.
Okay. There's a guy in Nevada who owns like a parcel of arid land that no one else wants in Nevada, and he has declared it in a republic.
Really?
It will never, ever get recognized internationally because it's in the United States.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a perfect example, Chuck, of what international recognition is like. Imagine if China recognized the Republic of Molassia as an independent nation within Nevada.
Yeah.
Can you imagine what a thumb in the eye of the United States is? It would go nowhere. There would be
sure.
Nothing. What are the Chinese aren't going to arm this guy.
Right.
Right? So, like, that's what is going on. I mean, think about this. Like, American Indian tribes, Native American tribes have petitioned for independence, and they can't get it. This guy in Molassia is never going to get it.
Yeah, and they were here long before that guy.
Now, imagine if this were serious,
mm-hmm.
and there were really huge mineral rights at stake.
Yeah, yeah.
These people were accepting arms. They were warring with somebody that could pull you into a war.
Sure.
Then it starts to get a little more nerve-wracking, but the thing's the exact same.
Yeah.
People recognize nations just to tick off other nations.
Right.
To embroil other nations in war or problems or to scoff at it. It's basically like pushing another popular kid into a locker. That's like recognizing a new nation.
Right.
That's often accompanied to it.
And then shutting the locker.
Yeah.
What does the guy in Nevada back his currency? Does he have currency or just...
He backs it with chocolate chip cookie dough.
And you pointed out that's not very valid, but I counter that, sir.
Okay.
And say that I would love for things to be backed with chocolate chip cookie dough.
Well, yeah. I mean, I guess I would too, but after a while I'd be like, I don't want any more money.
Yeah, that's true. You eat enough cookie dough and you're going to get sick to your stomach.
I would strongly recommend reading that Chicago Tribune story on that guy because it is extremely interesting. It's called One Nation Under Me by Colleen Mastoni. It came out in 2008 on the Republic of Molassia.
Awesome.
He is not the only wacky guy running around with a saying like, I'm an independent nation.
Right.
He's actually not, I mean, he's kind of serious, but not really.
Uh-huh.
I get the impression he's half performance artist.
Sure.
There's a guy who founded his own nation in the 60s.
Yeah.
Off the coast of Great Britain.
Yep.
And, it's still around today, Sealand.
It is.
It's an amazing story.
It is. I think they're making it, or they've talked about making a movie, and this has been requested. In fact, I didn't hear about this at all until someone had requested it, a while ago, about 6 months ago. So whoever that was, thank you.
So, Chuck, apparently in World War II, the British made a bunch of military outposts that were basically like oil derricks,
yeah,
or oil platforms,
uh-huh,
that weren't pumping oil. They were just stationary out in the North Sea.
Yeah.
Off the British coast to basically shoot down German airplanes in case of attack.
Yeah, just big, almost like stationary aircraft carriers.
Right, and they tore most of them down,
yeah,
after the war. Except they left one up, and apparently no one has any idea why this one particular one was left up. But it was about 7 miles, 7 nautical miles, which is like 1.1 something land miles.
Okay.
I don't even know why they have those.
What, nautical miles?
Yeah.
Hey, it's different out in the water, buddy.
Bet we hear about it. off of the coast of England, right?
Uh-huh.
Which puts it outside of the 3-mile range of territorial waters. Remember who owns the ocean?
That's right.
Okay. So this thing is in international waters.
Yep.
Even though the British built it.
Ruff's Tower was, mm-hmm, the name of this particular one. And like you said, it stayed there. Or the rest of them were abandoned and then torn down. And this one was just...
It was abandoned and left up.
Yeah, abandoned and left up. So a guy, a pirate radio broadcaster, which at the time England was lousy with pirate radio broadcasters that weren't allowed to broadcast certain things in England, so they'd go outside to international waters. And
that's what Christian Slater did.
That's right. And there's a movie Philip Seymour Hoffman was just in about pirate radio. called,
oh, okay.
I believe, called Pirate Radio.
Yeah, sounds familiar.
But anyway, this guy, English major Paddy Roy Bates, was a pirate radio broadcaster who took up residence September 1967, about 6,000 square feet, this platform is, and said, you know what? I'm the Prince of Sealand.
And his wife just shook her head.
And he said, but no, you're the Princess of Sealand, so don't shake
like,
your
okay,
head.
Okay, all right.
Yes, and then she was down with it. And this is the Principality of Sealand, and we are our own nation, and we are not a part of England. So be it.
Yeah.
And that was pretty much how it started.
So, this guy, I guess the story would probably end there. But this guy was bound and determined. He was dead serious.
Yeah, to get recognized.
Call him a crackpot or whatever, but this guy made this place,
yeah,
right?
One of the great crackpots, though.
So, I guess, what was that? That was in 1967.
Yeah.
The next year, the British Navy sailed into this guy's waters. They were aware of him.
Yeah, they went to fix a buoy.
Is that what happened?
Yeah, there was some sort of buoy out there that needed maintenance. So they entered his waters, air quotes, and his son Michael, actually, I think this was wrong. I think his son Michael is who fired warning shots in the air and got in trouble.
Well, you get the attention of the Navy when you start firing shots for their attention.
Sure.
You know? That was kind of a big deal.
Yeah.
Back on the island of England,
mm-hmm.
A lot of people were calling for this guy to be court-martialed or thrown in jail or something, right?
Yeah.
So a case was brought against him in the House of Commons or in the Common Court.
Right.
Right?
A lawsuit, basically.
And the court ruled, we can't do anything. This is not within our jurisdiction.
Yeah.
It's not within English jurisdiction.
And they went, sweet.
And through that ruling, it was recognized and documented that this guy had a de facto sovereign nation.
That's right.
The court of another nation, another sovereign nation, ruled that it had no jurisdiction over this place called Sealand.
This platform.
Yeah.
Out in the ocean. So 7 years later, they proclaimed a constitution. They have since then have developed a flag. They have a coat of arms.
Mm-hmm.
It's a
nice coat of arms.
Yeah, it's nice, and it's on the flag.
Yeah.
They have a national anthem. They have stamps. They have currency, Sealand dollars, which are equivalent to one American dollar. I guess whatever the American dollar happens to be, that's Sealand changes along with us.
Uh-huh.
And they had passports made.
Yeah.
And they gave them out to people. They didn't sell them.
There's about 200 of them in existence, real ones.
Today.
Yes. There's 500 times more forged ones in existence.
Right, because people started to use Sealand as like a...
way to open bank accounts.
Okay.
They just forged these documents, and since no one had ever seen them, people would say, what is this? And then they go do some research, and they'd say, oh, well, okay, this is a real thing, okay. And they would give them the loan.
August.
There'd be a lot of okays.
August of 78, let's flash forward a bit.
Okay.
They, quote-unquote, win a war. This guy named Alexander Achenbach, who called himself the Prime Minister of Sealand.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, when the Prince of Sealand and the Princess were on the British mainland, he sent in some mercenaries to take the, I keep wanting to call it an island, to take Sealand.
Why? I didn't find out why.
I'm not sure, to be honest.
Okay.
I guess he was, he said he was a Prime Minister, so maybe he was trying to, you know, he had had enough of Prince Roy's iron-fisted rule or something. And he wanted to take it for himself.
Right. He was tired of him strutting around.
So they sent these helicopters and speedboats in. There was a battle. They kidnapped the son, Michael.
Yeah, this is serious.
Took Sealand by force. And then Roy hears of this, obviously. He gets on it and wages a battle against these mercenaries and wins and retakes Sealand, holds these people captive, releases the Dutch. There were Dutch and Germans.
Right.
And charges Achenbach with treason because he was Prime Minister of Sealand, holds him, and this is the best part of the whole thing. Eventually, Germany sent a diplomat to Sealand to negotiate his release, and that is used today still as de facto evidence because an official diplomat from a country came to our country to negotiate with us. So that is de facto proof that we are a sovereign nation.
Well, it's proof 2 out of 2 at least.
Yeah.
Although, I mean, like all the stuff they were doing internally, like issuing passports and forming currency and a flag,
sure,
and other national treasures, that that definitely suggests that they're a sovereign nation as well.
Yeah, they proved it. They said, hey, this guy recognized us. This German diplomat came here.
Yeah.
So
but
that proves
and
it.
Plus, I mean, not just sovereign, but that's like a war.
Yeah.
They won the war, like you said.
Technically.
And also, that's a lot like The Mouse That Roared.
Yeah, I thought of that same thing, man.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's like almost exactly the same.
Yeah. Great movie.
What was that, 1959, I think?
The book or the movie?
The movie.
Yeah.
With Peter Sellers, uh-huh, David Niven, I'm sure. Those two are inseparable.
What was the deal? America declared a phony war on a small nation?
Oh, no, they... A small nation.
Right.
That was, like, going under, declared war on America.
Right, to get some
so
press.
So that they could surrender, not just get press, but so they could get international aid.
Right.
For having lost a war with America. Apparently the humanitarian aid pours in.
But they won, right?
Yeah.
Right. I remember I read that in high school, too.
Did you?
Yeah.
Good for you, Chuck.
So flash forward a bit more, and to 1987, Britain extended territorial waters to 12 nautical miles. The day before Britain does this, Prince Roy does the same thing. So they have overlapping waters, and even though they've never negotiated anything, apparently there's an understanding that it's split down the middle when this happens between countries.
You do not mess with Prince Roy. That's the understanding.
The other cool thing is because international law doesn't allow you to claim new land when you extend your sea rights, it was grandfathered in and just to this day is still sitting there.
Well, speaking of to this day, after like 40 years, Prince Roy's like, I'm done. I did it.
He's got to be old.
He is old. I think he tried to give it to his son. Son was like, "Nah." So Prince Roy is trying to sell it.
Michael's in London. He's like, "Yeah."
It experienced a revival with some investment from Haven Co. Limited, which basically says, "Hey, we have internet servers on this island, and they're in a sovereign nation, which means they can't be shut down except by attack."
Right.
And that attracted a lot of people who like Pirate Bay.
Sure.
Rogue BitTorrent sites.
Oh.
Mirror their stuff on these servers.
Gotcha.
It's a lot like the internet's version of offshore bank accounts in the Caymans.
Gotcha.
So did they sell it? The Pirate Bay was looking at buying it, I think, in 2007, but it fell through. As far as I know, you could conceivably buy Sealand today.
Well, Pirate Bay was going to buy it, but they found out there was no hardwood floors under the carpet, so they said, nah.
Yeah.
No, thanks.
Or they were rotted.
Right.
Yeah. So that's Sealand, eh?
Yeah, and it's still going strong. They claim de facto recognition still to this day.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's a sovereign country.
Yeah.
Dude, if Britain's like, we can't mess with you, and they won a war with Germany.
Right.
Okay.
And he doesn't pay into the health system. Britain said, all right, you don't have to pay into the health system.
Yeah.
But don't call us when you get sick.
Yeah.
Probably.
So that's what's considered a micronation, although I realize there are also other micronations that exist only on the web.
Right.
We need to do one on those, I think.
Have we not? Mm-hmm. All right. It's on the list.
All right. You should go do a little more research on this on howstuffworks.com. You should probably check out How Do I Start My Own Country, for starters. There's some good links in that article, too. We mentioned Who Owns the Oceans. You need to know that.
Mm-hmm.
And then How Currency Works is probably a good one to brush up on as well, right?
Yeah. Go read The Mouse That Roared or watch it.
Yeah. Do that, too. You can find all that by using the Dapper search bar at howstuffworks.com, right?
Mm-hmm.
I said Dapper, so that triggers listener mail today.
That's right. Josh, this is another update from Sarah, the amazing fan.
Oh, hey, Sarah.
We get these usually around her birthday.
Mm-hmm.
And
she gets maudlin.
As everybody knows, we have been keeping up with Sarah since she was 11, the amazing 11-year-old fan, and Sarah's about to turn 14.
Wow.
Growing up not right before our eyes, but right before our ears. And she just writes the best email. So this is from Sarah. Dear Chuck, Josh, Jerry, Frank the Chair, handy dandy microphones, and last but not least, the Last Chance Garage hat.
Wow.
She wrote into my hat. Wow, what a year. I don't know if y'all have been keeping track. I seriously doubt it, but I can dream, right? But I will be turning 14 in 15 days on the 24th. And I'm not sure when this is coming out, but should be sometime around there.
Yeah.
Not only is my birthday in 2 weeks, but my 8th grade graduation falls on the day before, meaning that my class trip to Six Flags, by the way, is on my birthday.
Yay!
Smiley face. Because of the 2.5 hour to 3 hour drive, I'll probably be listening to some epic podcast on the way. Now to the real topic of this email, I must share my hardcore parkour experience. After I read the blog that Chuckers posted on parkour in the computer lab at school, I went on a parkour rampage. Well, not really a rampage, but I just decided to randomly walk up to things, jump next to them, and say, parkour! When I did a parkour jump next to one of my friends, she goes, do you watch The Office? Apparently there was an episode where some of the characters went on a parkour rampage similar to mine.
Yeah, we mentioned that, right?
Uh-huh. I decided to look it up and found that it was really hilarious. You may want to start a parkour club right there at HowStuffWorks.com after
you
watch
this.
We are
way too fat and old for that.
Yeah, we learned that this week. So that's, she says, ha ha ha.
See, she knows.
Love and Rockets. Sarah, the amazing 13, almost 14-year-old fan.
That is awesome. And she made a Daniel Ash reference there at the end with Love and Rockets.
Yeah, I don't even know if she meant that, but I think it's an adorable way to sign an email if you're 14.
Well, it's Sarah. She's adorable all over.
Absolutely.
Sarah, happy, happy birthday. We're so glad you've been growing up with us.
Yep.
We appreciate you.
Yep.
You stay safe parkouring out there.
Please do.
Have fun at Six Flags. Be careful on the roller coasters. You know they make me nervous. And, well, heck, we'll say happy birthday again to you next year, okay?
Absolutely.
All right. If you have a flag, if you have a name of a country, if you have any ideas for starting your own country, we want to hear about them. You can post them on our Facebook page. That is Stuff You Should Know after / after .com after Facebook after www after / after / after a colon after a P after a T and after an H. Right? Do that in reverse order in a URL bar anywhere, and it's going to take you to our Facebook page. You can also reach us on Twitter at SYSK Podcast, and you can send us regular old-fashioned email to stuffpodcast@howstuffworks.com. Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh Clark. With me, as always, is Charles W. Chuck Bryant sitting across from me.
Mm-hmm.
That makes the Stuff You Should Know the podcast. There you go.
The only incarnation thus far.
Is there somebody fast-forwarding through this part right now, huh?
Yes.
So, Chuck, right?
Mm-hmm.
It is Chuck?
Yes, still.
Have you noticed how often I say right?
Yeah.
It's mind-numbing.
Plus, someone will write in and say, do you know you say right all the time? And or Chuck says,
Or it sounds like I'm eating hard candy all the time.
I know. That's not the case. You've never eaten anything in here. I can attest to that.
Yeah, I'm overly salivatory. Okay?
Yes.
Chuck, as you know, I was a student of anthropology.
Yeah.
Still consider myself.
Sure.
Such. And I first came upon this term called carrying capacity when I took this life-changing anthropology class, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember the teacher's name anymore, but he was awesome. He introduced me to probably my favorite article or essay of all time, The Worst Mistake in the History of the Human Race. Right, by Jerry Diamond. Awesome stuff.
By Dustin Diamond?
By Mike Diamond.
Okay.
By Jared Diamond.
Oh,
the guy
sure.
who wrote Collapse and yeah, yeah. Guns, Germs, and Steel and stuff. That's required reading, in my opinion.
Yeah.
I just think you should that essay, not necessarily his books.
Okay.
I was also introduced to carrying capacity, and there was this really cool video he showed us to get the point across. And it's just a map of the world, right? And it's there's red dots. It shows population growth.
Yeah.
And each red dot equals, I think, 1 million people.
Mm-hmm.
And so it starts out in Africa, in Ethiopia, I believe, mm-hmm. the cradle of humanity.
Sure.
And it starts there and all, you know, very slowly. There's like it's time elapsed, obviously.
Yeah.
So the years go by like that.
Yeah.
And the red dots start appearing very slowly, start moving out of Africa, spreading to Asia, to mm-hmm. Europe, all that. And then it starts to pop up around North America and South America. And then all of a sudden you get to the 16th century, maybe a little later, the Industrial Revolution. And all of a sudden this map just goes red. And it's really jarring. It really gets the point across that, like, how quickly population has grown in the world and the impacts of it. You know, that's why he coupled this with carrying capacity, because it's like, well, yeah, population growth, who cares? Then you say, oh, well, there's a limit to the amount of resources we have, and that limit is called the carrying capacity of Earth, meaning how much Earth can sustain human life. And there's supposedly a point to it, right?
Yeah. I got some stats.
There's my intro.
That was great.
Take it from here.
Here's a couple of stats, Josh. Okay. The United Nations Population Division estimates, because five babies are born every second, and 80...
Five right there. Yeah. 10.
Oh, 15. Man. You hear all that crying? All that poop?
Yeah.
The world is going to have 7 billion people by year's end, they think. 7 billion.
Yeah, we're at 6.92 and change right now.
Yeah. So, I mean, we're close. And to illustrate your point there about the red dots spreading like a disease that is humans.
Yeah.
Fewer than a billion people in 1800.
Yeah, it was like 800 million?
1800, dude. I mean, it seems like ancient history, but it ain't that long ago.
Yeah.
3 billion people in 1960, and only 6 billion people as recently as 1999.
Yeah. Between 1950, Chuck, and 1990, the global population doubled from 2.5 billion to 5 billion.
That is crazy.
And behind this, that's what they call exponential growth.
Yes.
It's not just adding like a million people a year. Slow and steady, you're adding a fixed number.
Yeah.
It's you're adding, you know, populations doubling in 40 years. That's exponential growth. And that is the basis of what a guy named Thomas Robert Malthus, an 18th century English clergyman, predicted in his essay, an essay on the principle of population, basically saying human growth is exponential. We have a big problem because the growth of food is not. It's linear.
That's right.
And we're in trouble eventually.
Yes. And he was fairly controversial at the time. He was debated by a lot of people, one of which was this dude named William Godwin. And he had a theory called the perfectibility of society, which is basically, no, dude, we're humans, and we, no matter how much we grow, we will be able to counter that with advances in technology to allow us to grow. So they debated like crazy. Godwin subsequently was one of the first proponents of anarchism. And Malthus talked about eugenics way back then, before it was eugenics. He said, I could see something like this being possible, but he said it's probably not something we should do. And he also, incidentally, was the one of the first people to support or popularize the economic theory of rent.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, he was just all over the place, wasn't he?
Well, but it all kind of ties into population, because eugenics tied into it, because he was talking about controlling population.
Sure.
And rent, he theorized, was only possible with a surplus of resources.
Yeah.
Which allows you to own a second place and rent it,
right.
I guess. Or rent a tool, or, you know, whatever people rented back then.
So what Malthus is talking about is generally classified as economics.
Yeah.
Right? But it's also, it stretches into all sorts of dirty, nasty little areas like greed, ecology, population control, so eugenics, family planning, abortion, infanticide, all sorts of stuff that has a lot of implications, far-reaching implications, right?
Yes.
And so I didn't realize that there was somebody who was a contemporary of him that argued, like, no, humans will use technology to outpace this Malthusian curse, is what it's called, right?
Yeah, there was more than Godwin. There was a few people, too.
I didn't realize that it was at the time.
Yeah.
But I know that over the centuries, people have been like, Malthus, that was a great idea, but you really missed the mark, and we're going to use you as an example of how badly somebody can get it wrong, right?
Yeah.
Because it wasn't just technology. There's another aspect of it called the demographic transition, which is basically as we get better with this technology, one of the things we come up with is birth control.
Right.
And while our mortality rates are lowering, so too are fertility rates.
Right.
And we eventually come to this thing called the replacement rate, which is 2.1 children per household leads to zero population growth.
Right. And I think they said in Western Europe the number was 1.4 in the late 90s. Like, some people are afraid that Malthus was correct at this point, and other people say that, like in Europe and Asia, they worry about the opposite because, you know, they have the problem over there that there are not enough young people to take care of the retirees one day.
Exactly. It's negative population growth.
So who's right? They do estimate who they is. I don't know. But it just said researchers estimate that population's not going to level off until mid-century at about 9 billion.
Well, that's at best. If we do level off, we could continue to keep growing. The rate we're at now, the replacement rate that leads to zero population growth, which is 2.1, right now we're at 2.6 worldwide. And with Africa skewing us the other way, sub-Saharan Africa has about a 5.1 fertility rate, which means for every household, there's 5.1 children born. Does that 0.1 child... I always feel so bad for him. It's just a knee down, you know, on one leg. But the if we can get to zero population growth, then we're not going to really have to deal with the Malthusian curse possibly ever.
Right.
But we're not. And that's one thing that's that Malthus didn't account for is things like as societies become more educated, fertility rates tend to drop dramatically.
Sure.
So that's another way to put it off, too. So he was scoffed at. Like you said, there's a lot of people out there who think he missed the mark. But people have been doing a little bit of math lately and have figured out that it's entirely possible that he's right, that somewhere down the line he's right.
Yeah, and at the basis, we should say, of Malthus's whole thing is a lack of food and water, really. I mean, we need air, food, water, shelter, and all that stuff. But what he was mainly centered on was eventually the food growth will not match up with the population growth. And a billion people go hungry every day already. So some might argue that that's already the case.
So let's talk about carrying capacity, Chuck.
Yeah, this is cool.
If we had not transitioned, which we have, which kind of proves the positivists camp, that we can be technological. Mm-hmm. If we hadn't transitioned from hunter-gatherer to agriculture, the carrying capacity of Earth would have been reached at about 100 million people.
Long time ago.
Yes, because there's just so many animals running around that we can kill. There's only so many berries that are going to occur naturally on the vine, right?
Mm-hmm.
But we did transition to agriculture before we hit the 100 million mark, possibly, maybe not.
Farming.
And we began to use technology, which is growing crops, to feed ourselves.
And animals.
And then we reached another point, right, where we hit what was called the Green Revolution. You remember that?
Yeah, well, yeah, I remember.
With Norman Borlaug?
Uh-huh.
Where there was a lot of people who were saying about a billion people are going to die because we are no longer, we're not going to be able to provide food for all the people here.
Right.
We've come up with great vaccines and all this other technology that's lowering the mortality rate, but that just means people are living longer and they need food longer over their lifespan.
Right.
Right. So what are we going to do? Norman Borlaug comes along and says, you know what we're going to do?
Tapioca pudding.
Exactly. Tapioca pudding for everybody.
For the elderly.
And a Care Bear in every garage.
No, go ahead with what he said, because he was a genius.
He said we're going to maximize the yield that we get out of arable land.
Mm-hmm.
We're not just going to plant some seeds and be like, hope you grow.
Right.
We're going to apply tons of pesticide, tons of fertilizer, and we're going to squeeze corn the size of your torso out of every plant. Right?
Yeah, he wasn't some like awful mad. That makes him sound like some awful mad scientist, though.
In the eyes of a lot of environmentalists, I mean, think about all the runoff, all the soil depletion.
Didn't he also win a Nobel Prize?
Sure.
Yeah.
He's credited with saving that billion people that were predicted to starve because he came in just in time because the Earth would have reached this carrying capacity for agriculture.
Right.
So we've had at least two different events where we were able to leap forward through technology and avoid the Malthusian curse, right?
Yes.
So there are people out there who say, well, you know, we're going to avoid it again, but what will that be?
Sure, and come up with another one.
So, I'm sorry, Chuck, we would have hit the carrying capacity 100 million where we hunter-gatherers, right?
Yeah.
So what are the predictions now?
Well, they say, and this is what I think is really interesting and completely sad, is that we have a potential carrying capacity of 2 billion to 40 billion.
Mm-hmm.
We're clearly past the 2.
Yeah.
So one might ask, how can it be that big of a range? And the answer is lifestyle. And here's a very sad stat. If the entire Earth lived like middle-class Americans, not the super rich, who, you know, probably consume more energy and the like than your average human.
Mm-hmm.
Just regular middle-class American folks consume about 3.3 times the subsistence level of food and 250 times the subsistence level of water, clean water.
Yeah.
And that means the Earth, if everyone was like us, the Earth could only support about 2 billion people. So what's going on is 25% of the Earth is consuming, I don't have the percentage, but the other 75% of the Earth is left with what's left.
Right.
Which is really, really crappy.
It's just disparity in the allocation of resources and what's consumed.
So that's why it can be a range of 2 billion to 40 billion because of the different lifestyles. If everyone lived like the 25%,
right,
there would be plenty for everyone and no one would be starving.
No, if everybody lived like the 25%, we would be...
No, like the 75%.
Right.
Sorry.
Well, that's where the 40 billion number comes in. I've seen 30 and I've seen 40 on the high end for the carrying capacity.
Yeah.
And that's where every square inch of arable land is being cultivated to its maximum yield.
Right.
And all people live in high rises that are as high as we can build them right now.
Right.
Right. And we're mining asteroids for minerals and all that. We're no longer going to the Earth. We're going to outer space.
Like terraforming Mars, maybe?
Possibly. Don't think that shouldn't have started about 50 years ago, right? But the that 40 billion prediction is based on the absolute minimum requirements. And everybody, 40 billion people living on the planet,
yeah,
all using the minimum amount, which is 400 liters of water a year and about 300 kilograms of food a year. Mostly grains. And you can basically kiss meat goodbye.
Yeah.
Because we need that land to grow our grains rather
which
than grow grains to feed cows.
Right, right.
Which is another way that the West consumes resources more than its fair share through a meat-rich diet, which is you're not only eating the meat, you're eating the grains that the meat ate.
Right.
Right? So, Chuck, let me ask you something.
Okay.
If you went home and turned on your tap and there was hot water and it was flowing and it was as much as you liked, right?
Mm-hmm.
Would you care how you were getting that?
What do you mean? How it was being delivered through my faucet?
Yes.
Is this a trick question?
No, it's not. Let me rephrase.
Okay.
If you went home and
I'm answering it wrong.
And turned on your hot water and there was as much hot water as you wanted.
Yes.
And you knew it was coming from a sustainable source. Would you care?
If it was sustainable?
Yeah.
I guess not, but I'm kind of like a water saver, so.
You're a water saver. What if you knew you didn't really have to save water because it was so sustainable? You wouldn't care. No one cares as long as we have the luxuries that we're afforded.
Yeah, I see your point.
You don't care if it came from burning banana peels.
Right, right.
No one cares. The problem is that the problem with the course that we're on apparently right now is that we are using technology not to get more from less, but to get more from more cheaply, right?
Yeah, it's a uniquely human thing, they call it in the article, which is pretty much true. But technological advancement is in many ways leading to our habitat destruction. Ideally, at this point, everyone would be on solar, and the massive companies would be solar powered and all that kind of thing.
And that's another great point is, you know, you don't care where your electricity comes from. Do you care if it comes from a solar panel or wind?
No.
Of course you don't. You just want your electricity.
Yeah.
So if we had invested or if we could invest our technological advances into getting what we have now from less,
e.g.
solar radiation or wind power,
right,
then we would be That's true cutting-edge technology rather
right.
than, you know, figuring out ways to deplete things faster, more cheaply, which is the way we're going.
Yeah, like thinking of, let's say, a more efficient oil driller or a more efficient way of getting coal from a mountain, i.e. mountaintop removal.
Mm-hmm.
So they're using technology, but they're using it in ways that are also destroying the habitat. And sustainability is all about finding the right balance in your habitat.
So here's the conclusion I came to from reading this, right? The argument from the positivists camp, I don't even think I'm using that word correctly, but the people who are the optimists camp.
Sure.
Duh. right? Are they're saying no? Malthus was incorrect because he failed to account for human ingenuity,
mm-hmm.
and as population grows, so too do the number of geniuses.
Sure,
and that's where innovation comes from.
Yeah,
right. I think the optimists are missing a point in their model, and that is greed.
Mm-hmm.
You can't really sway greed to benefit human ecology, can you?
No, I mean, you can't convince an entire population of people to change their lifestyles, which is what it would take.
That's what I'm saying. You can't because they don't care.
Right.
But if you could deliver them that same amount of hot water,
right,
that same electricity,
uh-huh,
and it was coming from a sustainable source, no one's going to fight that.
Right, right, right.
Right? It's having to get them to fight that fight to get the people who are controlling it to change over. They're not going to do that. So there's that fatal flaw in that model that the gloom and doom camp has over the optimist camp, and that they don't account for greed.
Yeah. Have you ever seen Who Killed the Electric Car?
No, I never did.
I encourage people to see that. That's pretty scary. The EV1 was, I mean, I don't know if you remember, but the EV1 was ready to go. There were TV commercials. You can look up EV1 commercial on YouTube, and they were running them on television. Electric cars are here. They're not coming. They are here. And boom, it was gone.
Really?
Yeah.
I'll check it out.
And I'll give you a few guesses as to why it left so quickly.
And
not only were they gone, dude, they literally gathered them all up and crushed them.
Really? Like so many E.T. Atari game cartridges?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, sad. But go rent it. It's cool.
Yeah. And
powerful lobbies out there.
What else you got?
I got nothing, man. This is a good one to chew on for people, I think.
I think so, too.
We just encourage people like we always do, just to, you know, we're not saying, you know, quit your job and go, like, build solar panels for a living and live on a wind farm. You can do that. That'd be awesome. But little things, little positive steps. Save a little water. Save a little power.
I disagree, man.
What?
I don't think the onus is on the people. I think the onus is on the people who are misdirecting technological advancements.
I'd say it's on both.
I disagree.
You don't think the onus is on the people to conserve?
No.
Wow.
I think it is. I think we've put it on the people, but I don't think it's going to make enough of an impact.
All right.
I think it's on the policymakers. That's who I think it's on.
I think it's on both.
Okay. Well, that's a debate to be played out on the Facebook page if you ask me, right?
Yeah, man. We should set up a forum.
So if you want to learn more, type in, has the Earth reached its carrying capacity? Or Thomas Malthus, M-A-L-T-H-U-S, in the search bar at HowStuffWorks.com. It'll bring up some pretty cool stuff.
Yeah.
Well, then that means it's time for listener mail.
All right, Josh. I'm going to call this How to Make My Teenage Son Listen to Your Show. From Portland, Oregon. Hi, guys, and Jerry. When you have a teenager, you will quickly learn that you can't just tell them what to do and expect them to do it. I remember those days. It's so frustrating because as a parent, you know that your kid will love something and get lots out of it, but you can't come right out and say it, or they will never, ever try the thing you told them to try. For example, your podcast. I knew for a fact, like I know that it will rain in Portland, that my 13-year-old son, Ethan, would really love Stuff You Should Know. Because I love the podcast, I've turned other people onto it, and they love it, but I knew I had to be sneaky in order for my son to give it a try. Ethan is a fencer, and at the time was also working on a research project about Renaissance jousting and tournaments. So one Saturday, I was working in the kitchen. I played How Knights Work to catch his interest. Every time he came in the kitchen, I'd hit play. When he'd leave, I'd hit pause. I would figure he would just think, man, these guys take a long time to finish a sentence. He would hang around the kitchen longer and longer each time, and I could tell I almost had him on the line, like I was noodling. Although, you would say I had him on the arm.
Yeah.
There's no line. When it was over, he said he already knew everything you talked about in the podcast, but I could tell he was intrigued. Then I hit him with the Scooby-Doo show, and that was it. You had another fan. Now he has downloaded the app for his iPod.
Nice.
And listens each night as he's going to sleep.
Wow.
And
talk
that is
about
from,
recruitment.
Yeah, that's from Afton Inn, a very sneaky mom.
Thank you.
In Portland, Oregon.
Thanks, Afton.
Mm-hmm.
That also kind of ties into the cults and brainwashing episodes, too, doesn't it?
Yeah, and she said when she replied, I asked her if I could read this. She said, sure. And she said, I guess he'll know my little trick now, but he'll get such a kick out of being mentioned, Ethan the Fencer.
Yes.
He will forgive that.
Yeah, and at least he can rest assured that she's not, like, putting anything in his soup to get him to do what she wants. She uses more subtle tactics than that. Right?
I wish he could put something in soup to make people listen to this. I'd be putting it in soup.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
I'd put it in all soups.
You've been listening to Josh and Chuck and the radio version of Stuff You Should Know. If you'd like to contact Josh or Chuck, you can email them at stuffpodcast@howstuffworks.com. You can subscribe to the twice-weekly Stuff You Should Know podcast and other podcasts at howstuffworks.com, as well as on iTunes. This is WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, and online at WFMU.org.
You're tuned to WFMU. This show's called Downtown Soulville. I'm Mr. Finewine. I'll be here till 9 spinning Soul 45s for you. And I got a special guest joining me in the studio. We'll meet him shortly. His name's Justin Salinas. He's here all the way from Minnesota with a box of 45s. Some good stuff, I presume. We'll hear from him in a little bit. 201-200-WFMU, the Soul Line. You can email me at finewine@wfmu.org. Soul music on a Friday night.
It's a summertime.
It's summertime.
Living in the
season. Living in season.
Fish are jumping.
Fish are jumping.
Oh, and the cotton is high.
Cotton is high.
Oh, now your daddy's rich.
Daddy is rich.
And your mommy's good looking.
Mommy's good looking.
I saw how the hot little baby.
Hush, little baby.
I saw how the hot little baby.
Hush, little baby.
I saw how the hot little baby.
Hush, little baby.
Don't you cry.
Home.